65. It's one of those two.
Well, it's probably the winter of 65. But.
Okay, this is talking with E.G. Taffy Bowen at the Australian Embassy on 24th December, 73. Well, can you tell me a little bit about how you began in the whole business?
Well, let me give you some prehistory.
Prehistory, okay.
I was involved in the first airwarning radars in England, of course, in 1935. And the first piece of equipment we built to get reflections from aircraft was essentially a high-power ionospheric set running around 100 kilowatts in output. And at that time, we apart from echoes from aircraft, we had two observations of which would have been of great scientific interest if we were able to follow the map, but of course we couldn't. First of these, speaking with hindsight, of course, is that we were getting enormous numbers of echoes from meteors around about 120, 140 kilometer mile. We knew they were in the ionosphere, but we didn't realize that they were meteors at that time.
Right, or from their trails, more exactly, I guess,
And of course it was Hay who, much later in the piece, realized what was going on. We were too busy on looking in other directions to follow it up. The other observation, which is relevant, is that when the ionospheric conditions were suitable, we were getting long-distance echoes from the European mainland, from Norway, Scandinavia, in fact, we were pointing in that direction, across the North Sea. And again, we realized that what was sending the signals back, and of course we could recognize the times when we would, in fact, break through the ionosphere and look straight out. Well, that was around about 1935, 1936.
But let's go back a little bit more pre. You are Australian, I'm sure.
No,
you're not.
British.
You're actually English, so that's why you were in England. Okay.
Yeah, and I didn't, as I tell you, I didn't get out of Australia until 1944.
I see.
And I'll relate that to you.
So you were working on this radar during the war, and you mentioned also about antenna temperature. Could you
yeah, but what I just described dates around about 1935-36. But certainly by 1939, before the war had started in 1939, when we knew we were breaking through the ionosphere and looking in out into outer space, we were certainly talking at that time in rather vague terms. First of all, of matching, of the matching of the, or mismatch of the antenna system to free space, which is a theoretical concept, but we were also speculating about what noise in fact we would receive, and we were thinking in terms of noise temperature, that pre-frequencies and the and so on. But that concept was normal to us in 1939.
And you did know about Jansky's work, I presume.
Oh, yes. Jansky only, for myself, I knew about Jansky's work at that time, but I didn't know about Riva.
That's right, because he didn't publish until 40 was the first paper.
I really forgot.
I think it is, yeah. But let me also ask, what frequencies were you operating at?
The original air warning radar, 1935-36, was in fact 50 meters, which we quickly pulled down to 26, and then to 13 meters, sort of somewhere in there, 13 to 26, that we were breaking through the ionosphere. That was the reason for coming down, of course.
I see,
The ionosphere was giving us a lot of trouble.
And I suppose also you got more definition, or were you worried about that at all?
No, we were after definition, too. Of course, there were equipment limitations that stopped us going down too far.
Right.
Well, I think the next significant item related to radio astronomy is the fact that I came over to the United States in the 40s and was involved in, in effect, in the beginnings of microwave radar at the radiation lab at MIT. And in the course of that, I became familiar with two or three or four things which relate to radio astronomy. Well, the first probably was Southworth's measurements on 10 centimeters, I think, of solar temperature, in which he first thought he checked.
That was actually done at the Bell Labs.
That was done at Homedale, at the Bell Telephone Labs, with his own equipment, which, of course, Bell Labs were working on as extensively as MIT, especially in the receiver end.
Was this sort of a parallel effort, or?
Partly parallel, partly contracted, and I would say that they were the receiver experts, but they were usually had their heads in front at Southworth, Fries, and England, and a few people like that.
And what was the expertise at the radiation lab?
Oh, it's very close to it, and derived from it, I would say.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Southworth measurements, I remember talking to Southworth about them, seeing his equipment. I didn't actually see it pointed at the sun. I didn't read his reports at that time, but I was familiar with his 6,000 degrees and the fact that later on he corrected that and made it 20,000 or something.
Exactly. But did he issue a report at that time?
I'm not sure that he did.
I've never seen a reference to any.
No, I don't think so. It was material in his notebooks and so on.
That seems peculiar, because that would be of interest to the military and so forth, wouldn't it?
No, I think it's indicative of our overall thinking at that time. stuff bounced off the ionosphere, breakthrough, and matching my antenna to free space. All of these were peripheral things. The main objective was, you know, something to do with detecting an aircraft or a ship or what have you. I think this is a rather important comment. I don't know quite how to formulate it, that anything that these people did, hay and so on, was peripheral.
Yeah, that's right.
In those days. Well, that was Southworth. I was familiar with what Dickey was doing, radiation lab, not 1 centimeter. And
you were mentioning Dickey's.
Yes, I was familiar with his measurements on the moon on 1 centimeter. Now, I left the radiation lab to go to Australia. We'll come to that in a minute. In 1944, but my present recollection is that Dickey had already measured a temperature on the moon in January 1944. Right. Of course, he didn't write it up till later.
Right.
Now, I could be wrong.
He didn't even write up that measurement, though, ever.
No.
If indeed that's correct, yeah.
Now, I could be wrong about that.
Yeah.
That's saying my recollection isn't entirely clear. I certainly didn't see any reports at that time.
Well, I'll check with him on that.
Yeah, but he wrote it up later, 1945 and 1946, I believe, when the whole thing gelled. But I seem to have in the back of my mind the recollection that he'd done it prior to January 1944. And of course, in this same context, I certainly knew about Hayes' observations of the sun in 1942, reported in the Army Operational Reports in England. And lastly, it was at that time that I became aware of Reber's work.
Mm-hmm.
I was familiar with Jansky from way back, of course, but not Reber's until the hay and the Southworth work sort of brought it to a focus.
Something just occurred to me. How did it happen that Reber stayed out of the war effort? I never thought about this before.
Honestly, no. I don't. I have no idea at all.
I mean, he must have had the biggest issue in the world in the middle of this huge war. And
that's right. No, I can't answer that at all.
Well, related to this, I'm interested in the development of paraboloid dishes. Was Reber's indeed the first dish of that size?
First of any size. Now, I should say the first ones that came into use for radar purposes were the airborne radar dishes, which were 30 inches in diameter.
And when was that?
That was in 1940.
That was actually after Reber's.
Oh yes, well after.
Yeah.
And I can claim some responsibility for kicking that off, and for the weight of 30 inches. But I was involved, as you probably know, in 38, 39, 40 with the airborne radars in England, the air-to-air radars and the sea search radars.
No, I'm afraid I don't know. So
which were on 1.5 meters, which is the shortest wavelength that those present-day techniques, those techniques of that day could take us down to. Now, the trouble with a wavelength of 1.5 meters is it's all round looking.
Right.
So we were very much disturbed by the direct signal from the ground. In fact, you had to get to, say, 15,000 feet before you could detect an aircraft at a range of 3 miles.
I see.
Because the ground echo was always so strong you can't do anything about it. And it was at that time questions of using a shorter wavelength came into the. And we explored the question, how short do you have to go in order to eliminate an echo from the ground? And the answer was 10 centimeters. You've got to get right down to 10 centimeters. Oh, this, by the way, was determined by the size of antenna, which you could put on an aircraft.
That was the limiting factor, yeah.
Yeah, and in the night fighters of those days, that's the bullfighter and the mosquito, you could put an antenna. You had about 3 feet, and you could put an antenna of 30 inches. And that was the dimension for a very long time.
And this was actually located right up by the nose?
Right in the nose. Yeah.
But I guess that's right, it was mainly for use at night, because in the daytime you could just see the, presumably,
yes.
Or poor weather, I guess.
Sure. Yeah. Night and poor weather. But the shipboard radars, of course, air to ship radars, had very nearly the same limitation. There's only a limited aperture up front. These were the first parabolic antennas which were used for radar purposes, and then shipboard radars came later, with bigger apertures, of course, and then ground installations with still bigger apertures came into the picture. But that wasn't until well into 42 or thereabouts.
He must have dreamed this all up by himself, so to speak.
With his 31, didn't come into the picture, I don't know.
Well, I'll have to ask him that.
Yes.
So what was your main effort at the radiation lab?
Airborne radar.
Mm-hmm.
Just by way of comment, it isn't relevant. I put the first airborne radar into a U.S. aircraft here on the Potomac in October 1940.
Right, at Bowling or at NRL?
In the Anacostia River. It was a PBY flying boat.
Oh, I see. Right in the river.
And we used to fly out of here, go over the Atlantic, checking ships, and that was at the time, if you remember, when the German submarines were sinking craters off the coast here. So it made quite an impact. And there was a big airborne effort in the U.S., of course, at 1.5 meters.
Yeah.
Prior to the microwaves coming into the picture. But those were my two activities. I put the 1.5 meter airborne radar business into operation in the U.S., and I helped with microwave radars.